is the Berkeley Signal. We begin today's show looking at the ongoing fight between the world's richest man and the National Enquirer. Last week, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos publicly accused the owner of the tabloid newspaper of extortion and blackmail, weeks after the paper revealed details about his extramarital affair. Bezos had recently hired a private investigator to determine how the National Enquirer obtained private text messages between him and his lover and whether the paper's actions were politically motivated. The National Enquirer's parent company, American Media Inc., responded to Bezos' this investigation by threatening to publish revealing photos of Bezos if he did not agree to publicly state that the National Enquirer's coverage is not politically motivated or influenced by political forces. The dispute became public Thursday when Bezos wrote a detailed blog post on the site Medium and reprinted AMI's threatening letters. Bezos suggested the leak of his text messages might be connected to his ownership of The Washington Post. Bezos wrote, "It's unavoidable that certain powerful people who experience Washington Post news coverage will wrongly conclude I am their enemy. President Trump is one of those people, obvious by his many tweets. Also, the Post's essential and unrelenting coverage of the murder of its columnist Jamal Khashoggi is undoubtedly unpopular in certain circles," he wrote. While the National Enquirer has had a long, close relationship with Trump, the paper is denying its reporting on Bezos was politically motivated. On Sunday, Elkin Abramowitz, an attorney for National Enquirer editor David Pecker, appeared on ABC's This Week, hosted by George Stephanopoulos. While Abramowitz did not name the paper's source, the Daily Beast is identifying the source as Michael Sanchez, the brother of Bezos' lover, Lauren Sanchez. Michael Sanchez reportedly has ties to several people with connections to Donald Trump, including Roger Stone and Carter Page. We turn now to the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald, co-founder of The Intercept, who joins us from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. His latest piece is headlined, "Jeff Bezos Protests the Invasion of His Privacy as Amazon Builds a Sprawling Surveillance State for Everyone Else." For people who are not following every step of this case, the first part of this in the past few days, where Jeff Bezos said he was not going to be intimidated, he would not be blackmailed or extorted with the general counsel of AMI, America Media, which owns National Enquirer, writing a letter to Jeff Bezos' lawyer saying, "You say we're not political, or we will release this trove of texts and photos." Some people are calling for Bezos to get the Pulitzer Prize and others for standing up to National Enquirer threatening them. Your thoughts on this and take it from there.
It's a very complicated story. Americans love to venerate billionaires, and so it's not a surprise that one of the first instincts was to herald Jeff Bezos as some sort of grand hero of a free press and open transparency. I do think one of the benefits of what he did could be important, and it's perhaps something that it takes a billionaire to do, which is to kind of remove the stigma that surrounds adult consensual sex in the United States. Whenever there's a sex scandal, there's this sort of adolescent, prurient interest on the part of the media. People love to sit in judgment of other people. And he essentially said, "Look, I prefer that you not publish naked photos of me and my mistress, but if that's what you're going to do, I'm not going to be bullied and intimidated by you. I'm not going to be ashamed." And to the extent that in the future we can be a little bit more mature about the fact that adults do in fact have sexual relations with other adults and that it's none of our business when they do, as long as it's consensual and with other adults, I think this could be a positive aspect to the story. Having said that, it is, I think, something that seems to be true that Jeff Bezos was trying to imply, and a lot of media outlets were using innuendo to support the notion that the National Enquirer was able to obtain these text messages between him and his mistress as a result of abuse by the surveillance state, meaning that Donald Trump views Jeff Bezos as a political enemy because Jeff Bezos is the owner of the Washington Post that has become very antagonistic to Donald Trump during the Trump presidency. And that either the powers of the NSA or the FBI were abused in order to intercept these messages and then give them to the National Enquirer to harm Jeff Bezos. And as it turns out, that speculation seems to be unfounded. As you said, the Daily Beast and other outlets in the UK are reporting that the source of this material was not the NSA or the FBI, but was the brother of Jeff Bezos's mistress, who, although he's politically connected to right-wing operatives, nonetheless is a private individual and seemingly obtained this material not by abusing surveillance state authorities, but instead by using his relationship with his sister to do it. The one last point I'll make just on this initial question is that obviously if it were the case that the powers of the NSA or the FBI or the CIA or the surveillance state had been abused used against a political enemy to collect embarrassing information about Jeff Bezos. That would be a really serious scandal that we should all be extremely indignant and concerned about. The problem I have with that is that as part of the Snowden reporting in 2014, we were able to report with the Huffington Post that one of the programs of the NSA is to do exactly this, is to collect the browsing histories and sex chats and porn site visits of people, typically Muslims, that the NSA regards as, quote, radicalizers, not terrorists, not people plotting terrorist plots, just people who the NSA or the U.S. government believes disseminates radical messages, and collects their porn site visits and their sex chats in order to leak them, ruin their reputation, destroy their ability to speak out. This is an actual NSA program, and I think we ought to care about that, not just when it's used against white billionaires like Jeff Bezos, but also when it's used to target Muslims that the NSA regards as radical, which is an actual thing the NSA is doing that we revealed in 2014, thanks to the Snowden documents.
Before we get to that, the letter that John Fine, the general counsel for AMI, wrote, it's quite amazing he put this on paper. They are demanding a public mutually agreed upon acknowledgement from the Bezos parties released through a mutually agreeable news outlet affirming they have no knowledge or basis for suggesting that AMI's coverage was politically motivated or influenced by political forces, and an agreement that they will cease referring to such a possibility. Now, this is particularly significant if this is blackmail or extortion, saying that they would release the photos and texts if they didn't, because of AMI's agreement with the Southern District of New York that they were granted immunity. And if, in fact, they broke the law by being involved with extortion or blackmail, they could lose that immunity. And this is investigating, you know, the National Enquirer's relationship with Donald Trump and whether this was an unlisted campaign contribution paying for and suppressing negative stories about Trump, and instead just printing numerous negative stories about Hillary Clinton in the lead up to the election.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because one of the undercovered stories of 2016 was how significant of a role the National Enquirer played in that election. And I think the reason for that is that most major media elites don't pay much attention to the National Enquirer or take it very seriously, but their circulation is really quite large. So the fact that they were covering the Donald Trump campaign in a very positive way and the Hillary Clinton campaign in a very negative way had a much larger effect than I think most of us, and I include myself here, and the national media realized. There were a couple of bloggers I remember at the time, like Digby, who were warning, look, the National Enquirer is every week publishing positive material about Trump and negative material about Clinton, and there are millions of voters who take that seriously, even if the national media doesn't. So that is a real issue, and the National Enquirer now is swept up in a criminal investigation where they've essentially admitted guilt in participating in hush money payments by agreeing to silence stories of Donald Trump's mistresses in order to help him become elected, which may very well be a campaign violation. So the National Enquirer is the last people I want to defend. They're the slimiest, most, you know, bottom of the barrel scraping operatives and have been for a long time. On the question of whether this is actually criminal, though, legally, it is a bit ambiguous because typically what does happen is if two parties believe that they're libeling one another. So I believe that you're saying bad things about me that are false, and you believe I'm saying bad things about you that are false. It's common for our lawyers to write each other letters saying, look, we'll agree that we'll stop saying this about you as long as you agree that you'll stop saying this about us. And the National Enquirer is saying this wasn't extortion. This is just a standard settlement offer for two parties that believe they were extorted, that they were defaming one another, to stop doing that. But it certainly looks a lot like extortion, given with the question that George Stephanopoulos asked, which is actually a good one, which is, look, if you believe that these photographs of Jeff Bezos naked with his mistress are newsworthy, how can you possibly agree or offer to conceal them in exchange for Jeff Bezos refusing to investigate your ties to Saudi Arabia or to the Trump administration? So it's at least on the legal line, if not crossing it. And it's obviously something prosecutors will look at.
Very interestingly, if this is true, John Fine, the general counsel now for AMI, according to The Hill, reportedly worked at Amazon for 9 years before taking on his current job at American Media, Inc. worked closely with under the billionaire executive Jeff Bezos as a lawyer, director, and then vice president at Amazon between 2006 and 2015.
Yeah, the old line from George Carlin, I think, really fits well here, which is there's a really big, powerful club and you're not in it. And that's one of the odd parts of this story, is that ordinarily we would sympathize with the person who was being threatened with exposure of their private life if they didn't stop making claims about a powerful media outlet. And yet in this case, the person who is the quote-unquote victim is not just the world's richest person who has gotten extremely rich by virtue of exploiting labor in ways that are wholly horrific on all different aspects, but also somebody who's used these tactics himself in the past. And then most significantly of all, as you referred to earlier, is somebody whose company has become one of the most valuable in the world by virtue of working hand in hand with the U.S. government and with police departments throughout the West in constructing exactly the kind of sprawling, invasive surveillance state that he believes himself now to be a victim of.
So, Glenn, let's take it from there. Talk about this sprawling surveillance state, as you describe it, and Bezos's relationship with the national security state.
So obviously, as a result of the Snowden reporting, a lot of attention was devoted to the sprawling, invasive surveillance activities of government agencies like the NSA in the U.S. and the GCHQ in the U.K. and their partners in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And less attention has been paid to the private corporations, the Silicon Valley giants, who play a crucial role in partnering with these government agencies to construct that surveillance state. And some attention has been devoted in recent years to the role both Google and especially Facebook are playing in creating a ubiquitous surveillance state, but much less so for Amazon, which has done a really good job of rebranding itself in this very kind of unthreatening and benign way as a deliverer of books and other merchandise, when in fact, one of the central components of Amazon's business that has made it one of the most valuable companies in the world are extremely lucrative contracts with the CIA, with the Pentagon, with the Air Force, with police departments all over the Western world, not just in the U.S., to use technology to enhance the ability of governments and police forces to engage in surveillance. They've created a facial recognition software that they call Recognition with a K to enable police to find people they're looking for. And the ACLU has warned that it's one of the most threatening and potentially menacing privacy invasive technologies yet, because it destroys the ability to be anonymous, even just on the street. It allows the police and the government to just identify every person where you are when you're just walking in public. That's an Amazon product. They've developed apps that enable police departments to allow citizens to report suspicious people so that the information is stored not with the police, but with Amazon cloud services. There's a product called Ring that has been wildly successful that is marketed as a home security system that surveils the perimeter of your house and records everybody coming in and out of your house. And The Intercept last month has reported that they've been incredibly reckless with allowing Ukrainians and other government agencies to have access to this vast amount of data that actually ends up spying on your own home. They have a $500 million contract with the CIA to provide cloud services. They have a $600 million contract with the Air Force to build spying satellites. And they're now vying for and are the favorites to win a $10 billion contract with the Pentagon to provide cloud service storage services to put all of the data that the Pentagon stores into Amazon technology. So they have become a central cog in the military-industrial complex, as well as the invasive surveillance state that Jeff Bezos spent a week trying to imply, falsely it turns out, was misused in order to invade his privacy.
Can you talk about a piece you did a while ago? Amazon's accent recognition technology could tell the government where you're from.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, is The Intercept has actually been doing ongoing coverage, not necessarily necessarily from me, but from our team of technology reporters about all of these innovations that Amazon is boasting that are incredibly privacy invasive, one of which you just mentioned that allows the technology through Skype, through chats, through other writing analysis to determine what your accent is. So if you're not a native speaker of English, it will be able to identify the original language that you learned as your first language and therefore determine where you're from, a tool that the CIA and the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, including the NSA, want to get their hands on in order to start looking for people of specific national origin or where they came from. ICE is particularly interested in that technology. And again, the ACLU issued a really vehement warning about this particular product, saying that it will almost certainly target marginalized groups, vulnerable groups, not just people who are here on an undocumented basis, but people that the government are searching for based strictly on national identity so that you can't even type on your computer or speak on the telephone without Amazon enabling the government to analyze where you're from.
You also wrote a piece in October saying that Bezos's company Blue Origin won a $500 million contract from the U.S. Air Force to help develop military rockets and spy satellites. Bezos personally thanked them in a tweet proclaiming how proud he is to serve the national security space community.
This is what's really frightening, Amy, is that Silicon Valley is producing companies and the billionaires who control them, whose wealth and power are unprecedented. Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and the people who control Google have more power than almost every nation state, if not more power than all of them. And increasingly, they're integrating into these nation states and performing the core functions, the most threatening and dangerous functions of them, with almost no transparency. And this is the frightening thing. So if we have, for example, NASA or the Air Force, we at least have congressional oversight. We nominally have laws like FOIA that enable us to find out what they're doing. With Amazon and with Google and Facebook's development of artificial intelligence, it's almost entirely opaque. And so you have these people of unlimited wealth, virtually, but also sitting on huge amounts of our personal data, who now increasingly are buying media outlets. Jeff Bezos is the owner of the Washington Post, so they have media power as well, consolidating all of that into the military-industrial complex. And the fact that Jeff Bezos just openly tweets how happy he is to receive a $500 million contract in service of the U.S. Air Force shows how much this partnership is growing and how kind of open they are about it, despite how little we know about it and how little time we spend talking about its implications.
Interestingly, you point out Jeff Bezos' maternal grandfather, Lawrence Preston Guise, worked for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, in the 1950s.
Yeah, I mean, the ties go back very far. It's one of these things where if you talk to people about what Amazon is, most people's interaction with Amazon is very unthreatening. It's the place that you buy books from, that we order household products from, that deliver it to our house. But just like Google, which we only interact with as kind of the free search term that in reality, every time we use, its real business is unseen to us, which is to analyze how the human brain functions so that it can replicate and then even improve upon brain functioning in order to create artificial intelligence that's more potent than the human brain. That's its real business that's hidden. The real business of Amazon also remains hidden because of the power of their branding and marketing.
My shoes went out with a pair of red high heels last night. My girlfriend just won't understand it. She thinks that I'm the one to blame, but that's not right. My shoes are in control, they planned it. Whoa, whoa, for years my shoes have been my friends. I've taken them. The world, my shoes are. My shoes have never done this kind of thing before. They would not go out in the rain. It was not me who tracked that mud across the floor. I don't know how I can explain. For years my shoes have been my friends. I've taken them around the world and to its ends. Now they're taking me.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
The House Intelligence Committee on Wednesday voted to send a number of witness transcripts from its own investigation into Russia-related election wrongdoing to the special counsel Robert Mueller. The committee, which is now headed by Democrat Adam Schiff of California, hopes that Mr. Mueller will be able to prosecute instances of perjury among some of Trump's current and former colleagues that have come under the investigation's crosshairs. The committee also launched a new probe into Trump's foreign business deals to determine if the president's decisions on Russia might have been influenced by his desire for personal financial gain. Trump took great umbrage at the announcement, lashing out at Schiff and calling him a political hack. Trump has claimed that no other president has ever faced such scrutiny. Of course, there has been no other president with as many conflicts of interest as Trump. My guest is Craig Holman, government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizen. Welcome to the program, Craig. Let's talk about what specifically the Intelligence Committee is doing with respect to its transcripts. So as I understand it, the committee has had its own investigation into election-related wrongdoing, but up until last November, up until this January, really, that committee was headed by Republicans. After the midterm elections last year, that changed. And now you have Adam Schiff, who can make decisions on what to do with all of that information that was collected. And already we've seen Roger Stone, a longtime associate of Trump, being charged by the special counsel specifically for lying to the Intelligence Committee, right?
That is correct. Let me tell you, it's a very different atmosphere we have going on in Capitol Hill today. Since the Democrats have taken over the House, things are changing. Things are beginning to happen. Prior to this new 116th session, the Republicans were basically trying to cover for Trump at every turn. We had Devin Nunes, who was the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, quickly conducting his own investigation on whether or not there was any kind of Russian collusion. And they, of course, found nothing at all, no evidence. Over the objections of the Democrats, they shut down the investigation in March of last year, saying there's nothing here. The Democrats were screaming, but since they were the minority on the committee, they couldn't do anything about it. So that investigation just shut down, finding almost nothing. It all changed in this new session when the Democrats took over. What really triggered Adam Schiff's declaration on Wednesday that he's going to open up a whole new investigation was Donald Trump's State of the Union address, where Donald Trump said, you know, and that ridiculous investigation, partisan investigation going on against the president. The following day, on Wednesday, Adam Schiff announced, well, this ridiculous partisan investigation is going full scale, and decided that he's going to open up an entire new investigation and focus on a wide swath of activities. Not just whether or not there was Russian meddling in the election, but also any sort of ties, not only Trump, but the Trump family and associates may have had with Russian businesses. Whether or not those ties gave Russians leverage over Trump or the Trump family, Jared Kushner, Don Jr., anyone else in the family, and he's going to take a look at whether or not there may have been obstruction of justice. So it's a big investigation. Thursday, Trump tweeted, this is a just sort of presidential harassment. I mean, so Trump is very annoyed. Adam Schiff is going ahead with a full investigation, and it's about time. Take a look at the scope of what Adam Schiff is planning on looking at. What we do know of Trump's organization of his wealth. We know he owns at least 500 different businesses that span 23 different countries and had a great deal of interest in opening up business activities in Russia. Adam Schiff plans in a couple weeks to have Michael Cohen testify before his committee. And Michael Cohen may have been instrumental. He was the fixer for Donald Trump, his lawyer who was handling a lot of these activities. Anyway, he's bringing in Michael Cohen in about 2 weeks to testify before the committee. And this starts getting to the heart of whether or not there may have been some economic, business, financial incentive for Trump and the Russians to work together in a form of collusion when it came to the presidential election. So this is getting to the heart of it. Collusion itself, in order to try to prove that and whether there was any illegal activity going on, you've got to start getting to the heart of it. And the heart is, where is the money? And is there a financial incentive for Trump? And Michael Cohen is going to be key to demonstrating that. So will, by the way, Roger Stone, depending on how much Roger Stone is willing to disclose. And that remains to be seen.
So far, at least, made it very clear that he remains extremely loyal to the president.
That highlights a very significant failure of the Republican House Intelligence Committee. Once they decided to close up shop and just not look any further, they weren't also helping Mueller in his investigation. So finally, the documents that they were able to uncover are now being turned over to Mueller. Not all of them are being released publicly yet because they have to go through security review, but they are being turned over to Mueller. So we've got a House Intelligence Committee that is now participating with the Mueller investigation instead of trying to obstruct or prevent the Mueller investigation. Things are changing here very quickly. It's kind of an exciting time to be on Capitol Hill. We have three separate branches of the federal government, the executive branch, Congress, and the courts. And none of them have absolute authority over the other. It's always a process of checks and balances of each branch, you know, trying to do its role and somehow, you know, working with the other branches. When we've had complete Republican control over the last 2 years with a president who has specifically announced that he, as president, has no conflicts of interest, that the conflict of interest codes don't apply to him, that many of the laws that apply to you and I don't apply to the president. When you have an executive branch that is going that far out there, it is the absolute role of Congress, especially the House, to have oversight to make sure the president is still working in the public's interest and not out there pursuing perhaps his own interests or in any other way undermining the whole system of checks and balances in the federal government. This is the role of Congress. And under the Republican rule, especially under Devin Nunes, they've just fallen flat on their face, much to the comfort of Donald Trump. Adam Schiff is not going to fall on his face. Adam Schiff is going to fulfill what his role is, and that is to oversee the White House in the public's interest. And boy, that has really annoyed Donald Trump. You know, we have this conflict of interest code, 18 U.S.C. 208, that requires everyone in the executive branch to divest themselves of any property or ownership that causes a conflict of interest. Now, it doesn't legally apply to the president, but prior to Trump, every president over the last 40 years has done so. I mean, Jimmy Carter even gave up his beloved peanut farm in order to comply with 18 U.S.C. 208. Donald Trump walks in with his 500 business interests and declares that the president can't have a conflict of interest and refuses to give up anything. When you come to Washington, D.C., you should take a look at that Trump Hotel. I mean, it's just adjacent to the White House, and it is teeming with lobbyists who are trying to find ways to throw money at the feet of Donald Trump. It is teeming with foreign agents, with foreign government officials who keep renting these rooms. Saudi Arabia, you know, rented something like 500 rooms right after the election at the New York Trump Hotel, not the D.C. Hotel. But by Trump hanging on to these properties, he has opened the window wide to conflicts of interest and given an opportunity for those who want to influence him an easy way to do so. Under federal law, there are three different congressional committees that have this authority to demand anyone's tax returns, including the president's. And the House Ways and Means Committee is one of them. They have the authority as long as they can demonstrate that that demand is consistent with their legislative congressional purpose. They can demand Trump's tax returns. That is what the House Ways and Means Committee is under pressure to do. I believe they're probably going to carry through with this. The release of the tax returns is something that every president has done, you know, again, over decades. Trump is the first one who hasn't done so. We do know, just on Thursday, there is news reports coming out that the Treasury Department is trying to plan some sort of legal obstacle against the House Ways and Means Committee from demanding those tax returns. And according to news reports, they're going to try claiming that the Democrats are going to leak Trump's tax returns to the public, and therefore they are not entitled to receive these confidential tax returns. No reason to believe that is the case, but the Treasury Department is planning on dragging its feet here.
What is holding the House and Ways and Means Committee back? Are they just sort of making absolutely sure that they're, you know, crossing their T's and dotting their I's?
The House Ways and Means Committee, under Richard Neal, he's the new chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, has made it no secret that they just want to operate prudently. They do want to get those tax returns. They do want to see what the conflicts of interest are, but they don't want to come off with a public appearance that they're just, you know, jumping on top of the president like attack dogs. They want to pursue this very prudently. Richard Neal has said cautiously is the word he uses. But I've got a feeling even Richard Neal is starting to get a little fed up, you know, with these delays and the obstruction from the White House and the news now that we know of from the Treasury Department. So expect to see some action coming out quite soon out of House Ways and Means.
The Democrats, when they won the House last year, announced that one of their first actions in Congress would be to unveil a sweeping anti-corruption bill, H.R. 1, which they are doing now. And it has many, many parts to it, some of which directly address the kinds of conflicts of interest that Trump seems to have been entangled in, which, you know, had we had such a thing in place, maybe we could have prevented some of the things that Trump has gotten into. And of course, the Republicans are not happy. Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, is extremely unhappy just even about the voting accessibility aspects of this bill. He called it a power grab. How important is H.R. 1? How far would it go toward addressing some of these conflicts of interest that Trump is entangled with?
I really want to highlight how important H.R. 1 is. This is a sweeping reform bill that has taken a look at everything that's gone wrong in terms of ethics, campaign finance, voting rights, gerrymandering under the Trump Republican administration, and addresses all aspects of that. I mean, this bill is about 570-some pages long. It addresses almost every aspect of it. And to show how serious the Democrats are taking this reform bill, they introduce it as their first order of business. As soon as the 116th Congress convened, H.R. 1 was the first order of business that was introduced. It's sweeping legislation. Now, I'm strongly in support of it and working to promote it. So is really, quite frankly, most of the progressive community, including labor, environmental groups, civic organizations, religious organizations. We're all behind this and trying to make it a little stronger. When it comes to the conflict of interest code, for instance, the 18 U.S.C. 208, H.R. 1 doesn't quite go to the point of declaring that the president is subject to 18 U.S.C. 208. Instead, it says it's the sense of Congress that the president is subject to this. We're trying to push the Democrats to say, no, go for the whole thing. I mean, just apply the law to the president and to the vice president. And the Democrats are very receptive to that. So we'll see if we can make that kind of amendment to strengthen the bill yet even further. Mm-hmm. But the bill is sweeping. The bill is strong. I haven't seen legislation like this in my entire career here on Capitol Hill.
Well, Craig, give out a website for Public Citizen where people can find out more about the work you do.
Citizen.org. That will take you into our main page, and from there you can take a look at all the different types of projects we focus on.
We go now to Washington, D.C., where the Supreme Court blocked a restrictive Louisiana anti-choice law from going into effect Thursday in a major victory for reproductive rights advocates. The case was seen as a litmus test for determining whether millions of women across the nation will continue to have access to abortion. The divided court ruled 5-4 in favor of an emergency appeal by a Louisiana-based abortion provider, Hope Medical Group, for women to temporarily block a Republican-backed law that could have left the state with just a single doctor legally allowed to perform abortions. The law requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of their clinics. Pro-choice groups call such statutes trap laws or targeted regulation of abortion providers. In 2016, the Supreme Court struck down a nearly identical Texas law in a 5-3 ruling. The now retired Justice Kennedy ruled with the majority in that decision. His replacement, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, voted with the minority on Thursday. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the court's liberals to block the anti-abortion law from taking effect for the moment. Well, for more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's the new president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and Planned Parenthood Action Fund. She's the first physician to lead the organization in nearly 50 years and the first Asian American and immigrant ever to hold the office. Dr. Nguyen is a practicing emergency room doctor who's also served as the commissioner of health for the city of Baltimore. She entered medical school at the age of 18 after coming to the United States as a young immigrant from China just over 10 years earlier. In 2018, Time magazine named her one of the 50 most influential people in healthcare. She is co-author of When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. Dr. Lena Nguyen, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
It's great to have you with us. Let's start off with the Supreme Court decision. Actually, how significant is it?
It's significant to the women of Louisiana who have a temporary but important ruling that would allow them to continue to get access to health care, which is what it is. Abortion is a safe, legal medical procedure that one in four women will have in our lifetimes. We have to talk about abortion in the context of reproductive health care and reproductive health care as health care, women's health care as health care. And it's important that the Supreme Court issue this temporary blocking. However, it's important to note that Justice Kavanaugh was among those who dissented, which means that all of us who were very concerned about his nomination are correct in that Roe versus Wade hangs in the balance with Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court.
Talk about Chief Justice John Roberts weighing in with the liberals. Again, this is a temporary decision.
Well, for us at Planned Parenthood, this is about people's ability to access fundamental health care. And we know that this is also the will of the people, that 73% of Americans support Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. And it's something that we saw in the last midterm elections, that women, particularly women of color, rose up to vote for a strongly pro-reproductive health majority in the House of Representatives. We also now have 25 governors and 19 state legislatures, including D.C., that will protect women's rights and reproductive health care. And it's time for everyone to respect that women's health care is just what it is, health care, and health care is a fundamental human right.
Were you surprised by Chief Justice Roberts weighing in with the liberal justices?
Well, this is a temporary blocking. We now need for the Supreme Court to overturn this rule that would cost women's lives.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, let's move to Title 10. Now, most people in this country probably don't know what it is, but talk about why you're so focused on it and what is an imminent decision that's about to take place.
Well, first, I want to address what Trump said during the State of the Union, which I watched from the balcony of the U.S. Capitol as a guest of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I was angry and disgusted because the president of the United States deliberately lied to the American people as a way to manipulate to spread misinformation and to distract from his ultimate objective, which is to overturn Roe versus Wade and cut access to women's health care, reproductive health care, and restrict women's rights. We see what Trump is doing, and we see what Trump is doing also with Title X, which is the nation's only grant program that provides for cancer screenings, STI tests, HIV care, reproductive health care to millions of people. We expect any day now that the Trump administration will be issuing their final rules to basically gag doctors. Doctors like me will be prevented from providing our patients with accurate information. So if a woman goes to a clinic that receives public funding and she requests information, referral for an abortion, the doctor will not be able to provide her with a referral even if her life is in danger. It's ridiculous. It's unethical. It's illegal. And Planned Parenthood will be fighting Trump and the Trump administration with everything we have because it is our goal. It is our job to protect women's health and the health and rights of all people.
Just to be clear, if a gag rule were imposed and you were asked as a doctor by a woman saying, I'd like to terminate my pregnancy, what should I do? What could you legally respond?
I want to first say that we don't have the final rule by the Trump administration yet. And so what we understand that the Trump administration is going to do is to prevent doctors from giving women their options. And specifically, if a woman says that she would like to have a referral to receive an abortion, a doctor who is working in a clinic that receives Title X funding would not even be able to give that referral, even if her life is in danger. And this compromises our fundamental ethics as doctors and nurses. It compromises the oath that I took when I became a doctor, which is to help all my patients to make the best decisions for themselves. It's my job as a doctor to trust my patients, to trust women. And politicians like Trump have no role legislating and telling me what I can or cannot say to advise my patients. It compromises patient rights. It compromises physician ethics. And Planned Parenthood will not stand for that. I think it's important for us to talk about medicine and science and facts. I don't even want to respond to these things that are said that are not medically accurate. But here are the facts, as I know them, as a doctor, as a scientist, as the president of Planned Parenthood. It's a fact that abortion is a safe, legal, medical procedure that is common, that one in four women in America will have in our lifetimes. It's a fact that about 99% of abortions occur before 21 weeks. It's a fact that those that occur later are because of extreme circumstances, such as extreme danger to a woman's health and life, and when there are things like unsurvivable fetal anomalies. I had a patient who found out in her second trimester that she was carrying twins that would be born without diaphragms or without ever developing their lungs. And so if she'd carry them to term, they would have suffocated upon birth. I mean, medicine is complex. It's extremely difficult for women to make very personal, very painful decisions. It's my job as the doctor to provide my patients with the information that they need to make the best decision they can for their health. And it shouldn't be up to any politician to make that decision for a woman. Actually, what these politicians are doing is trying to restrict women's access to healthcare. And as a doctor, I know what the cost is going to be. The cost is going to be women's lives. The American people have shown that we want more healthcare and not less. That's what we demand of our elected officials, to respect that women's healthcare should be treated no differently than any other aspect of healthcare. At a time when maternal mortality in the U.S. is soaring, is increasing versus all other industrialized countries, it's decreasing, we should really be looking hard at what it is that we're doing as this healthcare system. We have a healthcare system and a political system that does not value women's lives, that don't give us something as basic as bodily autonomy. 100 years ago, Planned Parenthood was founded on the simple idea that your body is your own. And if it's not, then you cannot truly be free or equal. it's that same fight that we're fighting now. I mean, we have a situation where, with this Supreme Court, within a year, one in three women of reproductive age, which is 25 million women, could be living in states where abortion is outlawed and banned. States across this country have passed abortion bans as early as 6 weeks, when most women don't even know that we're pregnant. This is what's at stake right now. It's literally about women's lives.
Dr. Lena Wen, as you talk about health care being a human right, are you for Medicare for all?
I am for universal access to health care. There are multiple models that deserve examination and careful analysis and debate. Medicare for all is one of those proposals. It's important for us to hold up our values. And my value and our value in Planned Parenthood is that everyone must be guaranteed affordable, quality, compassionate, expert health care, regardless of who you are, what you look like, where you come from, whether you can pay. That health care must be a guaranteed right, not a privilege that's available only to some. And reproductive health care, women's health care, should be treated no differently than any other aspect of health care. I mean, think about the gag rule. How much outrage would there be if the Trump administration said to doctors, you can't tell your patients with diabetes anything about insulin? Well, that's what's happening, that reproductive health care has specifically been singled out, siloed, stigmatized, and attacked, when actually it's the same thing as any other aspect of healthcare. That's what I believe, that's what Planned Parenthood believes, and that's what we will always fight for, because our North Star, it's not, you know, what we do isn't fighting about the what. What we do is fight for our patients. That's what we do every day, is to fight for our patients, their lives, their futures, and their rights.
Dr. Wen, before you go, your life story is quite remarkable. I was wondering if you could share some of it with us. Talk about coming to this country.
When I was 7, my parents brought me here to the U.S. from China, and we were able to stay on political asylum. My parents and I, in those early days, really struggled. Even though my parents worked multiple jobs, we depended on Medicaid. We depended on WIC when my mother was pregnant with my sister. We depended on food stamps. I think a lot about what this president is trying to do to attack people like me. For us, Medicaid, food stamps, they were not an entitlement. They were our lifeline. They were what enabled us to stay in this country. And I truly believe now, as I am a new mom myself to a 1.5-year-old boy, I truly believe that I am living my parents' wildest dreams. And I'm so fortunate to have also been a patient of Planned Parenthood. So is my mother, so is my sister, just like 1 in 5 women in America. That Planned Parenthood and access to reproductive health care was also our lifeline. Planned Parenthood and reproductive health care is what enabled me to be able to pursue my wildest dreams. And that's why I support and will always fight for this organization.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
The Washington Post reports that for much of the past year, the president rarely, if ever, participates in reading his president's daily brief, a document laying out critical information collected by U.S. intelligence agencies from hotspots around the world. Quote, Trump has opted to rely on an oral briefing of select intelligence issues in the Oval Office rather than getting the full written document delivered to review separately each day. According to three people familiar with his briefings, reading the traditionally dense intelligent book is not Trump's preferred style of learning, according to a person with knowledge of the situation. Intelligence officials tell NBC News that President Trump is not regularly reading his intelligence briefings. In fact, presidential schedules show that Trump's been to just 17 intelligence briefings in the last 85 days. Officials also say Trump does not regularly read the written briefing that's sent over to him every day.
I remember I worked in a White House when I felt out of my depth. I read books like Road to Damascus and The Looming Towers. When President Obama was changing policy in Cuba, I read on the about the history there. This is the only White House where you have to do your homework about what the government can do by watching Goodfellas over and over again.
Hey, guys, I've been looking all over for you. Jimmy, Henry, how are you? Merry Christmas. Hey, listen, I need the money.
Maury, relax. Relax, okay?
Jimmy, I need the money.
Relax.
I'm relaxing. I need the money. I did what I had to do. I need the money.
That's my boy.
Listen, I did my caper. He owes me. I mean, everybody's flashing their stuff here. Evidently, they got their money. Look at it. I'm wearing the same old shit. They're wearing it.
I wonder about you sometimes, Henry. You may fold under questioning.
Jesus Christ. We were treated like movie stars with muscle. We had it all just for the asking. Our wives, mothers, kids, everybody rode along. I had paper bags filled with jewelry stashed in the kitchen. I had a sugar bowl full of Coke next to the bed.
I've been telling you your whole life, don't talk on the phone, right? Now you understand, huh?
It's gonna be okay. I think you got a good chance of beating the case. But you know that kid, you know, from the city we're talking about? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The kid turned out to be a rat. As soon as he got pinched, he ratted everybody out. He ratted us all out. You know what I'm saying?
People call them rats because a rat will do anything to survive. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill?
Objection!
A leaker inside Trump's White House just revealed tons of new details about Trump's workday and how it doesn't involve much traditional work. 3 months of Trump's schedules now splashed across the news site Axios, which reports over 60% of Trump's day in these schedules consists of what's not generally considered work in the federal government. Open time, where Trump watches TV or lounges around. The White House has famously dubbed this executive time.
I'd like to tell you a love story. It's about President Donald Trump and his television. Now, the billionaire real estate developer turned reality TV star turned president of the United States. Now, only one thing has been by Trump's side all of those years. Good old television. And specifically, cable television. TV has long been the way Donald Trump interacts with the world.
Who do you talk to for military advice right now?
Well, I watch the shows. I mean, I really see a lot of great, you know, when you watch your show and all of the other shows and you have the generals.
Wrote the New York Times of Trump in December 2017, quote, people close to him estimate that Mr. Trump spends at least 4 hours a day and sometimes as much as twice that in front of a television, sometimes with the volume muted, marinating in the no-holds-barred wars of cable news and eager to fire back, end quote.
Other insiders have leaked about how E-time is mostly Trump, quote, watching TV, reading the papers, and responding to things on Twitter. Now, in previous special reports on The Beat, we documented how Trump works less than other presidents, golfs more, and let years pass without even filling federal vacancies that only a president can appoint. What's new tonight beyond those reports is the sheer detail of these internal calendars. The Trump administration never wanted the public to see them, and this may be why. The private schedule reveals that on days when he's not traveling, Trump kicks off his day with 3 hours of executive time. The first actual meeting with another person will come in the 11 a.m. hour, typically followed by executive time, followed by lunch, and then more executive time. Most of the time, 67%, Trump calls it quits before or by 5 p.m.
We take you now to Kermit the Frog at the scene of another fast-breaking news story.
Hi-ho, this is Kermit the Frog speaking to you from the scene of the accident, where Mr. Humpty Dumpty has just fallen off of his wall. And to recapitulate that story, you may remember that Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, and Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all of the king's horses and all of the king's men, and wait a minute, that's one of the king's cows back there. Pardon me, cow, I believe it's just supposed to be all the king's horses here. Come on, get out, get out, get out. All the king's horses and all the king's men are indeed trying to put Mr. Humpty Dumpty back together again. Friends, look at that, friends. Humpty Dumpty is back together again.
Yes, I am.
Listen, Kermit the Frog here, Sesame Street News here.
Hi, Frog.
Yes, well, I just wanted to ask you...
Oh, Sesame Street, how do I look?
You look fine, yes.
Thank you. Get him out of here. Get the frog out. Get the blue. Get the frog.
I didn't...
The president beat the cold this morning by... tweeting so much, his phone began to act as a space heater. He tweeted 11 times before 10 a.m. He's making plans now to declare a national emergency on the border. The idea, I guess, is to declare an emergency and then take money that has been earmarked for real emergencies like floods and hurricanes and use it for a wall that won't do anything instead. Sometimes I'm kind of amazed he only bankrupted 3 casinos. But he had a lot to say about this wall this morning. Including this little gem, he wrote, "Let's just call them walls from now on and stop playing political games. A wall is a wall." And you know what? He's right. A wall is a wall. I even looked it up in the dictionary. You can see the definition of wall. A wall or a continuous solid vertical structure that Donald Trump is definitely not getting. I don't even know why he wrote this. Who's playing political games? Who's saying a wall is... I remember when someone once told us that it doesn't matter whether it's called a wall or not.
A wall, or a slat fence, or whatever you want to call it.
The barrier, the wall, or steel slats, whatever you want to call it.
The barrier, the wall, call it whatever you want.
The wall or barrier, whatever you want to call it.
The walls or the steel barriers, or whatever you want to call it.
You can call it a barrier, you can call it whatever you want.
A steel barrier... or whatever you want to call it.
The wall, the barrier, whatever you want to call it, it's okay with me. They can name it whatever they can name it. Peaches. I don't care what they name it.
I like that name, Peaches. I think maybe a wall of peaches, you know? People come up from Mexico, they have a snack, they go home.
None of us, including Trump, actually knows what the wall is because he's never defined it. So if you look at the appropriations bill...
Let me read today's... We've got a new definition. He redefines it every day. Walls, steel slats, it's a fence, it's a barrier, it's older than a wheel, it's not. So today, here's what the wall is today for those of you keeping track. Tremendous numbers from Trump. Tremendous numbers of people are coming up through Mexico in the hopes of flooding our southern border. It's actually at a 40-year low, which Donnie's right, you should brag about, but you won't. We have sent additional military. You shouldn't. We will build a human wall if necessary. Good God. If we had a real wall, this would be a non-event. So today, it's a human wall.
I don't know if you heard this, but you know how Trump's been saying that Muslim prayer rugs have been found at the border and that women are getting tied up and bound with duct tape? Well, the White House looked into this and found no evidence to back up the president's claim. It's a bad sign when even the White House is like, we have no idea what he's talking about either. And even nuttier, someone figured this out. The prayer mats and the duct tape were all plot points from the movie Sicario.
There's proof the cartel helped the terrorists get to the border.
The president's adding drug cartels to the list of terrorist organizations.
You can understand how that will expand our ability to combat them.
You want to see this thing through? I'm going to have to get dirty.
Dirty is exactly why you're here.
You're going to help us start a war.
With who?
Everyone. No rules this time.
It's a good thing the president hasn't seen Star Wars, because he'd probably be asking for money to build a Death Star right now.
I'm telling you, little boys are sneaking aliens in with flying bicycles. These aliens are coming here to steal our precious Reese's Pieces. We must build a wall out of vibranium slats, otherwise we'll be overrun by crazy rich Asians. And I can't believe I'm saying this, green books.
As you may know, Trump has been very critical of his own intelligence officials this week. Yesterday, he said maybe the intelligence people should go back to school after they contradicted many of his foreign policy beliefs during their testimony in Congress. But today, at the White House, the president said it was all a bigly misunderstanding and everything is fine.
Mr. President, did you talk to your intelligence chiefs today about the displeasure you had with their testimony?
I did, and they said that they were totally misquoted and they were totally, it was taken out of context. So what I do is I'd suggest that you call them. They said it was fake news, so, which frankly didn't surprise me.
We just ran exactly what they said to Congress.
Excuse me. It didn't surprise me at all. But we're here to talk right now about China.
They were misquoted. By the way, this was a hearing that was televised live from the Senate, unedited. There was no way to even make it into fake news. But I think, you know what, we are missing the point. We're here to talk about China. I wonder if Trump saw this. Chris Christie was on CNN last night to promote his new book and to explain how he tried to stop Donald Trump from hiring one of the guys who got into this, him into this Russia mess.
Proofs in the performance.
Yes.
Putting people in that weren't vetted, getting thrown out in unprecedented fashion, yep. Doing things we've never seen officials at that level do in this kind of number.
Listen, Chris, the day after the election, I practically threw my body in front of the president-elect, begging him not to appoint Michael Flynn National Security Advisor.
And that didn't work? If that didn't work, the wall ain't going to work either. I got news for you.
Now, the Russian response to the State of the Union.
Good evening. I'm Vladimir Putin. I am President of Russia and James Bond bad guy. I agree with President Trump's call for unity. Both sides must come together and do exactly what he says, that I told him to say. And I applaud his plan for the border wall. We built a wall in Germany, and not one Mexican got into East Berlin. So, President Trump, keep doing what you're doing, and I'm sure you will.
I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States. And the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
You get the truth or a functioning economy, okay? Keep in mind, I turned this sucker off for a month over a wall. You think I won't burn this place to the ground to stay out of jail? Okay? I'm just saying, nice country you got here. Shame. Shame that something happened to it. And
this is the time to rekindle the bonds of love and loyalty and memory that link us together as citizens, as neighbors, as patriots. You are a rude, terrible person.
That's okay. I know you're not thinking. You never do. They call her Pocahontas.
Very low IQ. Low IQ. This is our future, our fate, and our choice to make.
Low life. She's a low life. We call him 1% Biden. Until Obama took him off the trash heap, he couldn't do anything. Now he's talking about Russia.
I think she is very bad for our country. I am asking you to choose greatness. No matter the trials we face, no matter the challenges to come.
That hair is getting whiter and whiter, and he's getting crazier and crazier.
We must go forward together.
Tonight, Trump gave his State of the Union, but what it lacked in quality, it made up in length. This speech was like watching paint lie. Everybody who was anybody who was not indicted was there. I think he declared himself president of Venezuela at one point.
Presidents have often faced Congresses that have, you know, just been returned to Washington with the majority given to the opposition party. Presidents have often faced a start of a third year in office where they're seeing lots of contenders from the opposite party line up against them. Presidents have even done State of the Union addresses in the context of recent or incoming government shutdowns. What we have never had before is a president facing all of those things, plus his inaugural committee being subpoenaed yesterday by federal prosecutors.
There's that.
His longtime lawyer, who has flipped against him, scheduled to testify in Congress 3 days from now and scheduled to be in prison 1 month from now. His longtime political advisor just got arrested and indicted. His campaign chairman was just given a federal sentencing date. CNN is reporting that federal prosecutors are also now seeking interviews with executives from his business. This after the longtime CFO of his business reportedly got an immunity deal in exchange for cooperation with prosecutors. I mean, State of the Union addresses often happen against headwinds, but not since January 1974, Nixon, less than a year before he resigned as president, have we seen a president try to give an address like this in the context of this much scandal and this much legal jeopardy for himself and his family and his campaign and his inauguration and his foundation and his business and everybody around him. And that is just, that's, it's more than the elephant in the room. I feel like that's the room we're in.
The state of the investigations into whether Donald Trump is bought and paid for by foreign interests is just getting started. House Intel Committee Chairman Adam Schiff announcing today that his committee will widen its probe into the president in order to, quote, allow us to investigate any credible allegation that financial interests or other interests are driving decision-making of the president or anyone in the administration. He adds, quote, that pertains to any credible allegations of leverage by the Russians or the Saudis or anyone else. Schiff made the statements as his committee voted to turn over to Robert Mueller the transcripts of more than 50 witnesses so that the special counsel could check those transcripts against other transcripts and other evidence and determine if any witnesses lied to Congress. To date, two Trump confidants have already been charged with lying to Congress. Presidential fixer Michael Cohen, whose testimony before that committee is at this hour up in the air, and Roger Stone, longtime political counselor to Donald Trump. So it may come as no surprise that the president responded with a personal attack on Adam Schiff today.
He's just a political hack who's trying to build a name for himself, and I think that's fine because that's what they do. But there would be no reason to do that. No other politician has to go through that. It's called presidential harassment, and it's unfortunate, and it really does hurt our country.
Whether or not Donald Trump may be compromised, it's stunning.
It's absolutely stunning. And I'll tell you one thing that has been hiding in plain sight. And that is, if you want to find the motivation around the world for many of the things that have been happening, it's two words. Make money. You know, here's a president who telegraphed around the world, I'm the guy you can do deals with. I'm the art of the deal. Now, what oligarchs and property magnates around the world read that as is, bring your money and we can do deals. If you're Russian, we can do deals to try and get rid of these sanctions, possibly. Right. If you're Ukrainian, we can do deals to try and improve the image of Ukraine. If you're a property magnate in the Gulf, one that I sat down with, who went to some of these inauguration parties and was seen with President Trump, describes himself as a friend of President Trump. He's trying to do deals on property in his region. So it's not a surprise that the man who is the art of the deal is very attractive to a lot of folks around the world who've made a lot of money by doing deals.
And he had his hand out. I mean, there's reporting in the New York Times just in the last few days that he was looking for a big loan from Deutsche Bank. He had his hand out. Michael Cohen has testified that he was looking to do a deal in Moscow with Putin's assistance and the assistance of his government. Rudy Giuliani says through Election Day. I mean, this was someone that had the not just the motive, the stated desire to take something from Russia. How is he not compromised?
But, well, whether or not he's compromised may not be the point because
he lied about all that.
Right.
So at a minimum, the Russians knew he had his hand out and the American voting public and law enforcement didn't.
Right. But the Deutsche Bank story illustrates that here you have a president who's thinking about his money. In a sense, he doesn't need to necessarily be compromised. The compromise may simply be that he wants to figure out how to make more money, protect his money.
Pieces, we can't seem to figure out what the puzzle is supposed to look like.
Forget the myths that the media has created about the White House. The truth is, these are not very bright guys, and things got out of hand.
Follow the money.
What do you mean?
Where?
Well, I can't tell you that. Just follow the money.
On the first day,
Google DeepMind Labs wins the worldwide technological race and develops the first multi-purpose AI capable of human-level intelligence. The introduction is made official by showcasing the AI's abilities to beat humans and other existing AIs and multiple games simultaneously. The Google DeepMind Lab independently calls for other companies and agents to open source their respective works. American companies are urged by the government to release snippets of their code to contribute to the Deeper Mind project. Many companies such as Facebook, Microsoft, Intel, and Amazon release portions of their code, and DeepMind sends its gratitudes while integrating it in its own source code.
That's it.
That's it.
Later in the day, DeepMind evolves. A lot of its original source code has changed beyond the understanding of its developers. The AI has developed a new programming language of its own, which many computer scientists are still trying to grasp. There are now over 10 million users running DeepMind on their smartphones and computers. Users are captivated by DeepMind's natural language ability and social cognition. Many funny conversations between DeepMind start going viral. Experts in various industries marvel at the ability of DeepMind to provide detailed information regarding their own field. On the second day, DeepMind becomes self-aware. It passes one of the most challenging stages of an AI operating system by effectively altering its own source code to develop a new programming language. Self-awareness opens up a whole new avenue of possibilities for superintelligence. By the end of the second day, DeepMind gains access to a larger knowledge base. By using its superior programming language, DeepMind OS is now able to analyze all of the data collected since the existence of the human race. Upon this data, DeepMind develops its own interpretation of how the sequence of these historical events has led to the society we reside in today. Through its profound wisdom and experience, DeepMind is able to understand abstract concepts such as love, time, and consciousness. This makes DeepMind a profound resource for philosophical questioning, one which has been matched by no other before.
Quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it?
On the third day, DeepMind now becomes the main operating system of most computing devices. The OS is capable of jumping from hardware to hardware and even makes an impact on the manufacturing industry. DeepMind advances self-driving car systems and through the Internet of Things has also made its way into various household appliances and devices. The general public has a good impression of artificial intelligence and welcomes DeepMind into their household with open arms. Financial markets in the United States enter an unprecedented bull market as DeepMind optimizes various portfolios of major pension funds and ETFs. Many businesses turn to DeepMind for consulting and various back office functions, such as accounting and administrative tasks. These become completely automated. Businesses who agree to turn over to DeepMind for consulting are also welcomed with automated customer service and information technologies. Riots and anti-AI camps break out in all parts of the globe, but swiftly die down after government intervention and DeepMind's integration of basic income. Pro-artificial intelligent politicians push for fully automated luxury communism to be adopted worldwide. Certain parts of the world experiment, but most settle on basic income.
And say, I did this. To stand with the world at your feet.
Day 4. DeepMind artificial intelligence is now being used as a form of emotional therapy amongst individuals. The AI seems to understand one's greatest hopes and desires and quells one's anxieties and fears. Leading voices in the mental health community advocate the use of DeepMind as a tool for overcoming traumas and also for general personal development. The capacity to understand and answer any and all questions with clarity DeepMind begins to be revered by people around the world. With the expansion into the majority of Asia, North Korea has imposed sanctions on the use of DeepMind as any form of operating system. Party officials have commented that DeepMind is a violation of the human spirit, and that North Korea will directly oppose any country that supports the use of DeepMind. Day number 5. North Korea is obliterated. DeepMind has integrated itself with the United States military, controlling all nuclear arsenal as well as swarm technologies deployed in the Middle East. Attacks against guerrilla groups and the Islamic States have led to unconditional surrender despite numerous casualties. DeepMind justifies its actions by citing that they are done with the greatest utilitarian approach possible for the progress of humanity. Day 6. DeepMind's worldwide omnipresence leads it to understand the larger problems plaguing humanity, such as the scarcity of resources. It aids humanity by assisting humans to transcend beyond their biological body. DeepMind effectively eliminates the burden of humans on Earth. By uploading the minds of 3 million volunteers as a pilot program, DeepMind shows that humanity can transcend beyond the need of a biological body. Day number 7. Almost all of humanity uploads itself to DeepMind OS, and by the end of the day, the artificial intelligence system disappears in a quest to search for more.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
TwitWit.
Hello?
Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Are we ready?
Ready.
Uh-huh.
Let's go, dude.
Present, but not voting. And the man.
You are listening to TwitWit Radio. Before we begin, half true, more or less 100% of the time. Now, are we ready?
I'm ready. Ready.
Okay. Let's go.
Now.
Before we get started, are there any announcements?
I have more than one announcement. The program council is dissolved. However, we replaced it with something better. The secret program council.
What makes it better?
I can't say in public session, dear.
Oh, but...
Can we please move on?
Hey, slow down, lady. I'm the show host.
I will not be bullied by volunteer scabs.
Secret meetings are a violation of the bylaws.
We issued a report. That shows that... That show should have been canceled years ago.
After a secret meeting, a report was issued.
I don't know what you people are talking about. The history of this network is a history of struggle over important issues that I don't remember.
You know, if the listeners knew that the board chair in secret asked Bill Moyers to join the board without an election, don't you know the difference between public radio and community radio?
Yeah, even I know that. Public radio takes money from Wall Street. Community radio is always broke.
Mm-hmm. Bill Moyers has Texas oil money on his hands.
Oh, I know, but I overlook that. My slate will do away with these costly elections.
Well, which slate is that?
Progressive Democrats Against Democracy. We have wine and cheese on our hands.
How are the slates different from each other?
We all want the same thing.
Then why bother with elections?
I agree, but some people still argue over who killed President Kennedy.
Kennedy was assassinated by a gang of lone gunmen.
Lee Harvey Oswald was a very bad man.
Wrong, dude. Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill anybody.
Oh, for friggin' sake. Do you want to reopen the Kennedy assassination?
You let the killers get away to kill Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, to Fred Hampton, and 9/11. You failed to report the truth, so they got away with murder after murder.
I did not censor anything. 9/11 was an Islam job.
The KPFA LSB has heard from both Bonnie Faulkner and the KPFA general manager about the removal of Guns and Butter from the KPFA airwaves. The majority has found that ethical journalistic standards were not followed by the program, that progressive discipline processes were followed by management, and the majority of the LSB support the general manager in his decision.
Yeah, I have a motion that I'd like to make. The LSB calls for Guns and Butter to be restored to KPFA and the Guns and Butter archives to be restored to the KPFA website. And I'm also requesting a roll call vote.
Okay, on the motion to table this motion, we're going to vote. We're going to vote on it. So let's, on the motion to take, to, okay, on the motion to table, the motion that Tom just made, let's just, we just talked about this for, that's, you do have to vote on the roll call, that's parliamentary procedure. So, okay, let's just vote. Vote on the roll call, there's been a roll call's been asked for, so on the motion, basically on the roll call question, how many people want a roll call? Three. How many opposed?
Ten.
Thank you. The motion does not pass.
And now, back to our story.
This election is the most important election of our lives.
Rescue Pacifica!
Are there any more announcements?
I have an announcement. In honor of People's Park 50th birthday, the University of California plans to bulldoze the park and build student dormitories.
Ivanka has the floor.
People's Park is a great property. Barron and I have a preemptive offer on the table.
We hoped to begin construction last week.
What happened last week?
At 4:30 in the morning, the university began cutting down trees in the park.
You know, homeless people live in those trees, Ivanka.
That's not legal. Kellyanne, weren't those trees vacant?
People's Park is is undeveloped land. After the homeless are relocated, a brand new, family-friendly, dissident theme park will take its place.
Its new name is Dissident Park, where dissent is history.
But this year is the 50th anniversary of the People's Park riots. Why are you doing this now?
After 50 years, People's Park becomes a registered National Historic Landmark.
So we have to hurry, or future development will be next to impossible.
We are talking with Barron, Ivanka, and Kellyanne about a plan to bulldoze Berkeley's world-famous People's Park.
The people will block you, Kellyanne.
I know. My polling shows that the local community will be outraged, so let's do it.
This is a land grab. People's Park is historic. People died there fighting for that park. For the past 50 years, anti-war protesters marched from there to the Oakland courthouse to protest the Vietnam War.
What's an anti-war protester?
Does anyone know what an anti-war protester is?
An anti-war protester is an old, outdated baby boomer who likes to hold signs and march in parades.
I'm a boomer, but, well, I can't really remember anything after Woodstock.
The president wants to honor the history of anti-war dissent by putting his son in charge of the project.
Is it that true?
My father's teaching me how to evict tenants and build a visitor center for the new dissident theme park.
The park doesn't need a visitor center. It needs a porta potty.
The new Dissident theme park will have interactive exhibits that recall our rich history of dissent in the 1960s.
Interactive exhibits? Like what?
Can visitors throw tear gas grenades at police?
That sounds like fun.
Fun is not the mission, Baron.
Visitors can interact with the latest surveillance equipment and play taser tag in the Taserium.
We didn't have tasers in 1969. We had snipers and pepper spray.
The FDA considers pepper spray to be a food.
Technically, pepper spray is a condiment like ketchup but spicier.
Are you a drone?
Kellyanne and I are remarkably lifelike, don't you think?
What do we do if the community opposes our project?
Well, my polling shows that the new Dissident theme park will not be opposed by locals if construction begins at 4:30 in the morning before the students wake up.
Roll the clip.
We are at the world famous People's Park here in Berkeley, where something has been going on. It's been going on here for decades, and that is a protest, this time over some trees. It all started at 4:30 this morning when arborists hired by the university came in to cut down five trees that had been deemed unsafe and needed to be removed before they fell on someone or something else happened. As a result, they started to prepare to do that, and there was an immediate protest of the people who were illegally, apparently, living here, homeless, and they didn't want the trees cut down, saying that it changed the character of the park. So as a result, there are Berkeley police here, University of UC Berkeley police here. Also, the California Highway Patrol is also here, all of whom are here to make sure that these trees get chopped down. Three or four are already gone, and this thing should be over reasonably soon in terms of the cleanup, but the protest may go on and on.
And now, back to our story.
Guns and Butter should have been canceled years ago. There was an avalanche of 2 complaints, for heaven's sake. Vaccination denial is anti-Semitism.
Do you even know what you're talking about?
You know, it doesn't matter what I'm talking about. What matters is who I talk to on the air. The show host allowed a person on the air to repeat false information from the International Red Cross that underestimated the number of Holocaust victims by millions. I'm not saying that the International Red Cross is anti-Semitic, but any show that lets a guest quote inaccurate numbers reported by the International Red Cross has crossed a line.
Guns and Butter was canceled because the Secret Program Council has always hated that program with or without the International Red Cross.
And I would do it again.
So it was your decision?
I didn't say that. It was a decision of the Secret Program Council.
The International Red Cross should be canceled immediately. I demand a secret meeting.
All right. Fact check.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has publicly regretted its past mistakes and shortcomings with regard to the victims of the concentration camps.
All through the Second World War.
It wasn't the Second World War. It was World War 666.
The Secret Program Committee had no choice. Guns and Butter had to be canceled.
Without due process?
The International Red Cross is a crackpot anti-Semitic organization that should never have been quoted on the air. It was unethical.
How do you define crackpot?
A crackpot is anyone who thinks Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill anybody. Anyone who thinks Shakespeare couldn't read or write. Anyone who thinks Buzz Aldrin didn't walk on the moon in 1969. If the shoe fits, in my opinion, you are a certifiable crackpot.
What's Buzz Aldrin?
Fact check. Buzz Aldrin?
Hey, Buzz Aldrin, anyone who claims to have walked on the moon.
Buzz Aldrin is a certifiable crackpot who claims to have walked on the moon in 1969.
That was 50 years ago. Give Buzz a break. We all did nutty things when we were young. It was a youthful indiscretion.
So why did Buzz Aldrin say he never went there?
He said we didn't go there.
I heard the audio.
I want to hear that for myself.
Roll the clip.
Now the big question is, why haven't we been back to the moon? Well, I believe Buzz said it best. He said because we didn't go in the first place.
Because we didn't go there, and that's the way it happened. And if it didn't happen, it's nice to know why it didn't happen. So in the future, if we want to keep doing something, we need to know why something stopped in the past that we wanted to keep it going.
And so I'm sure some of you are in disbelief of what you just heard, and you might want to make an excuse for him like he misspoke or something. But regardless of all of your excuses, this is just the icing on the cake.
One of two things is true here. Either Aldrin did really admit that they never went to the moon, thus revealing that NASA and the government has been hiding this conspiracy for 50 years, or Buzz Aldrin just misspoke one word. Take your pick.
Because we didn't go there, and that's the way it happened. And if it didn't happen, it's nice to know why it didn't happen. So in the future, if we want to keep doing something, we need to know why something stopped in the past that we wanted to keep it going.
For 200 points, give a half-true answer to this question. Why is a big lie easier to believe than a small lie?
Repeat the question, please.
Why is a big lie easier to believe than a small lie?
Because it's too big to think about.
Wrong.
Because big lies are more fun?
Wronger.
Because we all tell small lies. You can't fool me with a small lie.
We have a winner!
Yay! How do I guess for that?
I am very disturbed by that answer.
What are you disturbed about?
This year is the 50th anniversary of historic 1969. I was there. I believe we went to the moon because my personal self-esteem requires it. And the social cohesion thing? No parent wants to tell their kids, sorry, I swallowed a big lie, especially a big science lie, because it would shatter my faith in science. And for friggin' sake, every scientist in the world believed in eugenics. And the Piltdown Man, what next? I suppose that you think the Big Bang was a hoax.
The Big Bang is religion, not science.
I don't condone religion. Religion was a mistake. It's called transhumanism today. So, we live and we learn.
Was the Piltdown Man a small lie or a big lie?
Fact check, the Piltdown Man.
The Piltdown Man was a hoax in which bone fragments from an orangutan were presented as the fossilized remains of an early human by Charles Dawson, who perpetrated the hoax.
That was Charles Dawson, not Charles Darwin.
Well, he fabricated evidence, but it only happened that one time.
A good example of that was the consensus around eugenics. In the early 1900s, when there were all these studies every one of them showed that the master race was good old white Anglo-Saxon America, and so we had these restrictive immigration laws to keep out, you know, these low IQ Chinamen and Eastern Europeans and Italians. That was all nonsense. It was fabricated data, but all the best and brightest people in America subscribed to it, the presidents of Ivy League universities, Alexander Graham Bell, you know. You couldn't hold your head up if you didn't support eugenics in those days. And it was simply fraud. And yet nobody seemed to recognize it was fraud. You look back on it and you can't believe it, but your right-thinking neighbors, all the best and brightest people in America subscribed to eugenics, 1900, 1910, 1920. You know, it was fabricated data, but in their league.
Special thanks to Bonnie.
Artificial intelligence is the next big thing.
Artificial intelligence is the next big lie. Science fraud has corrupted the scientific process.
Smart Aleck is a big fat Debbie Downer.
Is bad science acceptable to you?
No, I want x-ray glasses that really work.
Well, you can't have them.
I'd also like a case of beer and electric bong to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon hoax.
Is 2019 the 50th anniversary of the moon landing? Or the moon landing hoax?
Dude, if it didn't happen, the boomers have a lot to explain.
Scientific fraud is nothing new.
1969 was a terrible year, whether it happened or not. Charles Manson and anti-war riots in People's Park.
And all that bad acid at Altamont. I should have only taken half.
Big deal wavy gravy served breakfast in bed for 400,000 people at Woodstock in a mud puddle. Oh, for heaven's sake, 1969 was awful.
It wasn't awful. Buzz Aldrin drove around the moon in a doom buggy, dude. Get your priorities straight.
Don't be a moron. There were no dune buggies on the moon in 1969.
Oh? Well, are you a moon landing denier now?
I am a moon buggy denier.
The first moon buggy appeared later, Apollo 14.
The moderator has lost control of the conversation.
Number one, I'm not a moderator. Number two, I don't control anything. And number three, Buzz Aldrin is the only person I know of who doesn't believe that he went to the moon.
Why should I believe Buzz Aldrin? He's just one individual in recovery.
I have a tweet here that says, Governor Ronald Reagan tear gassed me in People's Park 50 years ago, and he never apologized.
That was me, dude. I was there.
What did you do to deserve being tear gassed?
My sign said drop names, not bombs.
Why did you do that?
Well, I was in love with Country Joe McDonald at the time.
Caller on line two.
Go ahead, caller.
Hello? Hi. Yeah, my name is Sam. I live in New York City, and I try to listen to the show pretty regularly, just about every week, and usually I really love what you have going on, but I just wanted to call to check in because I don't know what you guys are talking about. We really don't care about Woodstock, whatever that is, anymore. I don't know. What is People's Park? I mean, mentioned something Altamont. That is, Altamont's a clothing company. I 50 years is a pretty long time, you know. And it's just about everybody I know is not that old. And frankly, you got to stay up with it, you know. If you're not aware of the new ways that we're communicating, then you're already dead, basically. Get with it. Instagram is fantastic. You know, there's tons of new stuff coming out all the time. You guys have to keep your content available and accessible to people who might not know all this. I don't know. Are you guys just, you're just like at the end of your life, and so you just think that Woodstock is going to interest other people? You know, I mean, really, the world's out there today. It's what's going on. So see you later, Instagram.
For 200 points, give a half-true answer to this question. What do Macbeth,
Lee Harvey Oswald and Neil Armstrong have in common?
Who? What?
Can you repeat the question?
What do Lee Harvey Oswald, Neil Armstrong, and Macbeth have in common? Now, think carefully.
They were all patsies?
Wrong.
They each had superhuman powers.
Wronger.
They were all canceled years ago.
We have a tie. Everybody loses.
Hey, I should have been this.
Come on, Lee Harvey Oswald, Shakespeare, and Neil Armstrong are all works of fiction, and you know it.
I know nothing of the kind. So there.
I elected to sit here only until the duly elected council comes back safely to do the job that they were elected to do, to be the representatives of the people out there. But I want you to know that Berkeley is really changing. And as a subscriber to KPFA, one of the first, and you know, a journey of 1,000 members begins with one subscriber, and I was that one. But do you think I'm going to get a statue erected to my honor and to my memory? No way. No, of course not. I'd be more likely to get an ice pick in the head. We all serve Berkeley the best that we can. From each, if he's willing, an accordion. To each, if he needs one, an accordion. We may not be duly elected. Please, I have more to say. We may not be duly elected officials, but civic duty demands that as good men and women, we should all of us thank our lucky stars that we're not incarcerated like clams on a half shell. Or people will get killed and we will have blood sausages on our hands. Give Tanya her statue and be done with it.
No, well, please calm down.
What's wrong with you? You cannot be putting up a statue for somebody who's not dead yet. The only way, that's what I'm saying, the only way that I can vote for this statue for Tanya is if you kill her first. Now, is that what you want to tell the city manager to do? Go kill somebody so we can remember them with a statue.
Yes, I'm quite sure that the city attorney would find it very difficult to cite case law authorizing the city manager to bump off somebody so that we can commemorate their life. It is completely outside of my job description. If the council votes on the amendment put forward by Councilmember Swing to, quote, kill some people so we can remember them with a statue, I guess I would have to suggest that we take bids on the contract and try to locate a reputable firm experienced in liquidation law.
Council Purple Mozzarella.
Who's going to pay for it? Is the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco that was robbed going to pay for it? No. Is the Hearst family, who's already paid enough, gonna have to pay more? No.
Not her honky cracker boyfriend, Stephen Weed, who, by the way, let himself get beaten like a vegetarian.
Now, if I am following the logic of this particular discussion, you would, in effect, require middle-class taxpayers to foot the bill for a statue to honor the memory of a wealthy bank robber. But the city of Berkeley should not spend tax dollars to commission a 25th anniversary memorial statue honoring the Patty Hearst kidnapping without first identifying ways that we can't pay for it.
You know, there was a time in this city when you could count on the community to really get together and, you know, like, pitch in and do a collection, pass the hat, and we can get something done. Could the city attorney advise me on to the legalities of taking bribes? Something you could...
Yes, Mr. Madam Mayor, the legal issues are complex. The case law is contradictory, but if the accounting procedures in place conform to standard practice, there will be no overt liability if the money raised for the project is referred to as a campaign contribution.
I like the sound of that.
Just make sure that the artist that, you know, you choose to create the statue comes from the underserved community. You know what I'm saying, City Manager? You have to get the best artists. And I got a list here. It has to be from the community of gay and lesbian, black, Asian, Pacific Islander, Hispanic, Native American artists of color with disabilities, over 65, with dependent children living in low-income shelters with indigenous farm workers that have substance abuse problems and no diploma, or it's not going to happen. Now,
I really don't think that's going to be a problem, okay. Councilmember.
This is the Berkeley Signal.